This is an MUT Radio podcast.
Hello, I'm Dr. Amalia Gonyas-Malka. Welcome to Womanity, Woman in Unity, the show that celebrates women's milestone achievements in their struggle for liberation, self-emancipation, human rights, democracy, and much more. Joining us today is Dr. Sarah Babb, who is an adjunct faculty member at the University of Pretoria's Gordon Institute of Business Science, and is also co-founder and MD of STIM, which was founded to stimulate neuro-inclusive communities and cultures across workplaces for neurodivergent adults. She holds a PhD in leadership development, MBA, PDM, and BA in industrial psychology. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Dr. Amalia. Such a pleasure to be here with you and your Womanity.
Dr. Babb, we engaged at the recent Gibbs Empower Her conference, which I thought was such a fantastic way to end Women's Month, to see all the different systems that women operate in and also how diverse they are. You have worked at the intersection of academia, business, and social impact for over 25 years. Can you tell us what first inspired you for leading change through complexity?
For me, My early years of studying coincided with the end of apartheid years. So I was on campus in the late 80s and early 90s and was drawn into student politics and working with transforming the education system and transforming the country, and completely inspired by what was possible in our future for justice and equality. Of course, that distracted from our studies, but it was a welcome distraction. But I learned so much in those days of the conversations we had about what is society, what is equality, what is equality from a gender and a race point of view and a class point of view, and what future systems do we want? And just a perfect opportunity to be considering alternate futures. And being a young student leader, also being able to experience leadership in quite a multi-perspective situation, which also taught me a lot around different perspectives, different worldviews, different assumptions, and again, being able to correlate and draw in the mixture of lived experience with theoretical frameworks, with actually what could the impact be socially. So the conversations to me were always rich and deep and meaningful and fraught and challenging, and not only on a personal level, but from a systemic perspective, while we're in the throes of moving into a democracy for South Africa. So I'm very grateful for those times. And for me, it is the epitome of leading change through complexity, when you have so many uncertainties, so many dynamics, so many different power shifts taking place, so many different opportunities, and really exploring what does it mean to step into creating different systems, creating different futures, creating a different discourse, different identities, which could be democratic and based on equality and justice and freedom. So very exciting and fraught and quite impactful years for me.
But it sounds like it's something that has also continued, because our world is evolving all the time. And I think it actually gets more complicated. How do you kind of manage this torrent of change continuously? And do you ever feel like you almost unlearn some things from the past in order to move forward and embrace the future?
Without a doubt, I absolutely agree. We're working in such a challenging and time of an influx of change on all levels, social, political, economic, personal. And yes, while we're working through what that change is, for me, it is about seeing what threads of possibility are there that we want to create a better future. So it's being able to really make sense of what are the dynamics that are unfolding, imagining the future that you want. But absolutely, if you don't release the past and let go and create space space for the new, that's where we get stuck. And one of my favorite terms, liminality, which I can come back to, is where many people do, and many systems and organizations and even countries and narratives remain stuck because of that inability to let go, which doesn't mean releasing completely. It may mean recrafting, reforming, reconfiguring. And that sounds philosophical, but a very practical term on an individual level. If you're stepping into a new role, then that means you actually need to let go of the old role. So if you were an expert or a specialist and you're stepping into a leadership role, it means not being able to collaborate with specialists and not necessarily being that person. From a country, creating a system that is democratic means releasing old systems that are not. So there's different elements. The one is making sense of what is going on in those dynamics and the interchange and the complexity, really understanding and stepping back from different perspectives to see that. Understanding then what are the kernels of the future that you may want to create for yourself or the organization or even your family or the country, and being able to step through that change. And it's often in that messy middle, that uncomfortable ambiguity, when we're living in that paradox and that tension, that we might be compelled to elastic with an elastic band to go backwards, but actually, how do we maintain momentum to keep moving forward? And I absolutely agree, we don't talk enough about letting go as an inherent part of any change. And that's such a important process.
So what have been the ways that you've found of releasing that elastic band and helping people let go and propelling them into the future?
I think there are a number of processes. So there's some frameworks that have been really helpful that I've worked with over my life. One of them is Theory U, which is Professor Otto Sharma, and he has a whole institute and way of thinking about systems change that really allows one to go deeper. So we often, when you say, how do we propel forward? Often we want to jump to action, jump to decisions. We want to choose what we believe is an easier route. And we think we know the answer based on old assumptions or experiences that are actually outdated in this world where we need new thinking. So Theory U encourages one, either individually or in a group or organization, to actually pause and to go deeper down the U. So to really understand what is the current reality and to pause before we jump into our first solution, and to almost have different a mindset of prototyping, experimenting, playing, looking at what's emerging from reality, and having that open mindset of flexibility. And on an individual basis, whether I'm coaching or teaching, the same approach works. I also work a lot with Dr. Dave Snowden's Kinefin framework, which is a framework of complexity, which talks about where you might see things as quite simple, but actually it is a complex environment. So just understanding what you're dealing with. So that notion of pausing in your life, is this just a quick decision I'm making, or is this actually looking at a deeper transformation? Really helps us then say, how do we play with different possibilities? And that's quite a liberating mindset to say it's not that we have to have the perfect answer before we try anything, but actually to free oneself up to say, let me try this route, let me imagine that route. So when I was working a lot with scenarios, what's interesting is that the analysis of scenarios starts with understanding the present dynamics, and actually not about using a crystal ball to imagine some alternate future, because all of our futures start with now. So if we're in current patterns now, so for example, I broke my ankle dramatically, fractured my ankle, and I was had cause to pause and was thinking about the habits I had that were not helping my health. So then imagining what different habits could I have in place that could create a stronger, healthier, fitter Sarah? And so then trying different activities and discovering that actually I quite liked CrossFit to my own surprise, which I wouldn't have imagined otherwise. So on all levels, I think there are different frameworks, processes that we can work with, allowing ourselves to imagine, allowing ourselves to explore, allowing ourselves to let go and create space.
I love how you've brought in those different frameworks, the scenarios that you've applied personally as well as externally, and in a way, giving people permission to explore and experiment. And given your work within the corporate or business space and thinking about the idea of being future fit, because we are rapidly moving to a future which is nothing like the present. From your perspective, what kind of elements would a future fit workplace look like, particularly in today's era of AI, digitalization, and global disruption?
What's so interesting to me in working with projects or processes around digital transformation or organizations automating or bringing in more AI support is that the capacities they've realized they've lacked most have related to human capacities. And that's been so intriguing to me. So, one project, for example, working with a big organization, they were digitizing the back-end finance function, and we were working with these highly qualified CA, financial managers who were quite lost in now being called to collaborate across functions and across disciplines, who were now being called on applying their critical thinking and strategic mindset to not spend hours doing the calculations and the spreadsheets and producing the financials, but actually in partnering with business to help them make better financial decisions based on what the system produced. So the shift for them was letting go of that identity that I spend days with my spreadsheet and my formula to look at financial outcomes, but actually now partnering, collaborating, helping make strategic decisions, thinking critically was actually a capacity that they realized they needed to enhance. So future fit firms to me is actually about how do we enhance that synergy between tech and humanity, tech and humans. So let's find ways that tech can do those repetitive processes for us, and let's look at how we can really be bringing in our capacities of creativity, critical thinking, collaboration, bringing in different perspectives, joining dots, because that's what will help future fit firms translate what the digital processes give them to actually informed strategic decisions and sustainable business decisions that actually can perform in their context and be creative and innovative into the future.
And in your future, fit organizations and firms, are you seeing more opportunities for women?
Yes, I would say so because I think there are a number of factors, but the one is I think tech is gender blind. So if you are drawn into a field that is supporting this future business, you won't necessarily be disadvantaged because of your gender. And there's a whole conversation about the STEM pipeline and actually why we don't yet have enough women in more senior positions in tech. But I think the potential is there in terms of where we're going. I think it's a societal perception that women have more empathy and a greater capacity to look at human connection and collaboration and understand with empathy their teams and their future. And one could argue that that is positive in terms of a leadership attribute in future fit firms. Because if we are building these digitally AI-driven firms that are humane or humanity-centered, then there should be a fit with women in terms of those capacities. I think we're still in a different context globally in terms of masculine leadership stereotypes, but I think the potential and future is definitely there, for women to step into more.
Well, let's say that the resources are there, the mindset seems to be there from women, but the reality in practice is that women are still seriously underrepresented in leadership positions. There were some 2023 stats from top 40 companies listed on the JSE, which I actually think are lower just because I know some of these women are no longer in their roles. But it indicated that only 10% of CEOs were women, 25% of executive roles in organizations, and 35% of board positions were held by women. So, given some of the work that you do in the leadership space, from your vantage point, what would you say are possibly the most persistent barriers that women face for stepping into leadership roles? And secondly, how can we overcome them?
I think that's a big, big question and a big mystery, and to some extent that we're still sitting with those statistics after these years. And I'd have to start with the individual perspective or the self identity, and how individuals are still looking at stepping into their full identity. I think the imposter syndrome, I think limiting beliefs still persist, given the hegemony, or the, as I say, the male stereotype of what a good leader looks like. And some interesting research also around some women choosing not to step into those roles because of the increased liability and the stress, and a choice, a lifestyle choice of, do I really want to take on this fiduciary duty as an executive board member or CEO? I would not leave it at the level of self, though. I think we still have so many barriers societally around the role of women taking on the unpaid work with families and with extended families, if not immediate families. And this is a societal stereotype that is perpetuating with our patriarchal systems. Interestingly, I'm still amazed that there's wage gaps, that there's still a mismatch between understanding exactly what a role needs and what the skills are. So I think I'm quite pleased by the shift in human capital to say, let's look at skills-based organizations and not, puff up job descriptions that might inadvertently exclude women because of unnecessary additions. So I think our systems of flexible work, and which really out of COVID times and the use of technology has allowed us to have more flexible hybrid work, will benefit women advancing too, because there's more flexibility. But without, also with many single-headed households, without necessarily having the family support to carry that unpaid work, there still remains a disproportion of time available to be able to commit to the roles that are required.
Yeah, you only have 24 hours in a day. I wish there were more.
Exactly. So there are women that have achieved a huge amount, and we're getting more role models. I mean, also we haven't hit that turning point. So from a role model point of view, if there are three women on a board, apparently that exponentially shifts the pipeline and the possibility of women moving through the pipeline. So I think there's still the need of the queen bees to be looking at how do we actually create pipelines and support each other in the industry.
It's
Industry.
interesting when you say that. And also, I mean, we're seeing this. So you're saying three women, and on average, a board probably has about 10 people. And the stats were showing 33 to 35% penetration. And I think it was Roger's theory of diffusion, of innovation, diffusion of innovation, where kind of critical mass starts to kick in at 30%. So maybe the tipping point is coming at board, and hopefully it'll ripple over.
Yes, I would hope that. I think I would believe that. So as you're seeing different role models, so you're setting an example and a precedent for so many people and youngsters to be coming into the workplace and moving through the ranks and believing that they can. Yeah, absolutely.
Now, another area of your work is in the neurodivergence space. And the truth is, not everyone fits into a normal box and occupies the center of the bell curve. You co-founded STIM to stimulate neuro-inclusive workplaces. Please tell us more about why neuro-inclusion matters, both for businesses and also for young neurodivergent adults entering the workplace.
So neurodiversity is really just how our brains function differently, how we perceive or our sense or sense our environment differently. So we have within that a different way of thinking. So we know, as we've spoken about, that future fit firms need different ways of thinking. We need diversity of how to solve problems, different perspectives of how to actually understand what's going on, being able to come up with innovation or creativity. We know that we need that diversity, but we've looked at seen diversities and not the unseen diversities. And actually, we have 15 to 20% of our population is neurodiverse. Divergent, which means that there is inherently already in your workforce and in your potential talent this different way of viewing the world. And so, if we think of organizations that have been really tracking this and it building projects around this. So SAP has a autism at work program. Ernst & Young has neurodiverse centers of excellence. Wells Fargo, IBM, Deloitte, many other organizations are beginning to see that the strengths of the neurodivergent profile actually bring value to an organization for this very reason. So finding increase in productivity and output and quality, and even in retention of staff, which is an interesting outcome of these projects. But neuroinclusive organization says that actually let's make sure that we're including all diversity of the of thinking within our workforce as a way of working, where we are allowing everybody to engage fully. I think that's the main reason that this would be an important business imperative. From an employee point of view, we also know that from the Gallup survey that 62% of our workforce are disengaged. So that means already our current workforce is there's presenteeism, there's lack of innovation, lack of discretionary effort for many reasons, stress and the context and pressures of work and other. So we really need to be, as organizations, looking at ways to include people that they are bringing the best of themselves to work anyway, because we have that that challenge. So how to improve our engagement. And then this is a reason, although I think it's a debatable reason, in South Africa, neurodivergence is classified as a disability, and the Employment Equity Amendment Act of 2025 expands the definition and to be more in line with the UN Convention definition, which talks about mentory and sensory impairment, which is really falls under neurodivergence. And we have the increased targets of 3% that organizations are encouraged to achieve in their employment equity plans. So imagine a world where we could be understanding our current profile, where people feel safe to disclose that they have ADHD or on the autism spectrum or are dyslexic, not as something to be afraid of, or not, it's not a medical deficit, it's not to be fixed, but it's part of the natural, normal variation of human functioning, which is Dr. Fung of Stanford's Neurodiversity Center's definition. It's part of our normal variation. We need that variation as humans wherever we are. But at the moment, we and companies, people are not disclosing because there is a lack of safety, lack of awareness, or maybe I'm not even aware myself. So if we could be looking at not even attracting future talent, great thinking, but even in our current talent, where are we missing opportunities to understand, to draw in the best of our thinking that is there already? So there are a few reasons for organizations to be really considering neuro inclusion from a holistic perspective.
The fact, though, that neurodiversity is classified as a disability does come across with some negative connotations to the public and makes an individual who may have one or more of these conditions maybe feel that there's something wrong with them.
Exactly.
But I'd like you to tell us about some of the strengths and unique capabilities that some of these conditions come with, because they are different in a positive way too.
Exactly. So my disclaimer is that actually everybody, it's so complex in terms of the neurodivergent profiles. There's many overlaps and different comorbidities. But just to generalize, some of the clusters of behaviors that have been found in ADHD, for example, an ADHD thinker is very creative. They almost talk about the spider web way of thinking, joining dots, seeing systems, understanding different dynamics. being creative, rapid decision makers, high energy when hyper focused, have great passion, courage, resilient, remain calm in the thick of challenges, big picture thinkers. And we know famous people like Richard Branson, for example, that may be an example of that. And there are different presentations of ADHD, so I'm generalizing enormously. Somebody on the spectrum with autism, again, there are also different levels of autism. It's persistent, is able to absorb and work with a lot of data, is very concrete, it thinks critically, has an amazing memory ability, can really go deep into a content, hyper focus, and is also honest and loyal. And again, I'm generalizing, but imagine those capacities in your business. So the entrepreneurial, creative, higher propensity for risk taking, looking at something differently, matched with somebody on the spectrum who can deep dive, solve problems, think critically. And even more interesting is dyslexia is the highest proportion of neurodivergence. You find because there isn't a reliance on text or reading, there's also a propensity to be very observant, very good social skills, amazing visual reasoning, good in social interactions, good in problem solving, and also really creative in their thinking. There's what's the spiky profile. Really, we neglect to look at these strengths, which could add great value. And when you're aware of them in your own life, it also helps balance where you may feel that you are less strong. So perhaps executive functioning or working memory or spelling might be, you might not be as strong, but then you're not caught in that narrative, but rather actually, how do we amplify the strengths of everybody in our workplace?
I really appreciate you sharing those attributes because they are strengths.
Absolutely.
One of the challenges, though, and you mentioned it briefly, is that when you are aware of something, when you have been diagnosed as something, then it, in a way, it becomes acceptable because you're aware of what the issue is and you can address it. We know that research suggests that neurodivergence in girls and women is often undiagnosed or even misdiagnosed. Why do you think that happens, and what impact does it have on women's career trajectories?
It is startling that the statistics of girls being diagnosed at school is still much lower. And I think there are a few reasons. The one is the initial diagnosis tools or instruments were based on white boys and white men who will mostly present ADHD differently, for example. As I mentioned, there are three types of autism: the inattentive, the hyperactive, and the combined. So our stereotype of the naughty boy being restless in the school class, disrupting, not being able to pay attention is our stereotype. And the diagnosis picked that up, but it didn't necessarily pick up the inattentive ADHD, which many girls have. So the tools have been biased, but also that girls at a young age are taught to mask. So to fit in, to be polite, to be quiet, to be kind, to consider others, to not disrupt, to not stand out. And that masking is really a way that girls have not been seen for the underlying challenges that they may have. So have often been misdiagnosed or undiagnosed until later on. So there is a growing diagnosis, but of older children. And what's incredible, at midlife, the diagnosis is doubling, it's surging. And that is a huge phenomenon globally. And the reason being, too, that so as a girl, you might get through school, you might become a parent, and mostly, of course, it can be caused through brain injury, but mostly neurodivergence is genetic. So now your child, because there's more access to diagnosis at school, there's more diagnosis of girls, you recognize in your child those behaviors in yourself. Where did that come from? Okay, now I'm seeing that in myself. That's one reason. The other reason is that Only recently, with the growth in research in women and menopause and hormonal fluctuations, has there been found to be a direct correlation with hormonal changes and neurodivergent traits being exacerbated. So when estrogen drops in your cycle or perimenopause or menopause, so your dopamine drops, and so it's harder to mask ADHD, for example. It's harder to muster up the energy to mask those traits or behaviors. And so you'll see that there's a correlation with midlife traits and neurodivergent traits coming through in older women. And so there's a surge now in trying to uncover what's going on of diagnosis of neurodivergence at that age. So I think with a combination of bias in diagnoses, of lack of understanding, of ma high masking in so many contexts of women, misdiagnosing in terms of hormonal changes or depression or anxiety, neurodivergence is only now we're realizing the scale and an impact that it has in the workplace. So now, if we understand it, as you say, then we can look at ways to work with it that's real, not. It's so misunderstood. For example, so I'm an example of a late diagnosis ADHD woman who was trying to work out why I was feeling exhausted and going through a battery of tests, and everybody was saying just rest, and not understanding why just resting wasn't helping and why masking was harder. But through understanding brings such a relief and liberation to finally put some puzzle pieces together and go, now I understand why I've made certain life choices. Now I understand why some things were so hard for me and yet so easy for others and so difficult for them to understand, and always somehow feeling a little bit different, but knowing that I could contribute so much. So it really helps to understand for yourself, but to find for yourself different ways of working with neurodivergence, and equally for other people to understand, albeit in a relationship or a workplace or even in a family. So it's such an important topic that I'm quite passionate about expanding our awareness and access to diagnosis and accommodations in the workplace.
It is fascinating. I wish we had more time to unpack this. To close off on this aspect of the conversation, I just wanted to ask you, are there any freely available diagnostic tools for people to perhaps investigate or explore if they feel maybe there's a reason that I don't fit in?
There are online some self-assessment tools based on the DSM criteria that you would qualify to be diagnosed as ADHD or autism or the like. Don't give you a formal diagnosis, but a good place to start to say, oh, I can understand now, that I leave cupboard doors open, that I don't have object impermanence, or that I have time blindness, that I think I can do everything in 10 minutes and then feel exhausted just thinking about filling out a form or waiting in a queue. So it definitely would help. But in terms of diagnosis, this is one of the passions that I think we need to explore more in the Global South, is understanding more the dynamics and intersectionality in our global South context, so it's not just driven from the Western world, and also to really consider how we can scale and make diagnosis more accessible in our continent. Because if you go for a formal diagnosis through a psychologist or psychiatrist route, it's very expensive, and that is prohibitive for many, many people. So this for me is also a point for us to really explore further.
It's a good call. And as we come to the latter part of the conversation, one of the questions that I ask all my guests on the show is about some of the factors that they feel have contributed to their success. Please, can you share what have been some of your key drivers?
One of my philosophies in life is to reinvent myself and to be conscious and proactive around that. And for me, that's such an important mantra for all of us, that it's not finite, it's never ended, there's so much more possible for all of us. So connecting with your purpose and your passion and recreating new futures keeps us fresh and focused and feeling that we have a meaningful life that we can contribute and be relevant and add value and make an impact is for me something that I've lived by that has served me well. And my wish is for all of us to keep believing that there are different futures available to us and our world, especially when we're feeling stuck or overwhelmed by all the dynamics that are going on globally or in our country or even in our world.
Lots of vitality to that, and this potential of multiple possibilities.
Absolutely.
Tell us about some of the pivotal moments in your life growing up.
I was my one of my pivot I must say one of my pivotal moments was so I was raised by a single mom who wasn't well off, but it really was quite focused on giving us access to my brother and I, giving us access to opportunities. And one of the things that she did, she was a travel agent for 14 years, an old-fashioned travel agent that used to write out tickets and work out your itineraries and talk about AI transforming jobs. That job doesn't exist anymore. But so while I was growing up in apartheid, she was committed to two things. The one was giving us access to knowing there's another world out there. And one of my pivotal moments was actually through her work, we were able to go overseas and go in the snow at age 13. So in a world that was very sheltered and cut off, deliberately cut off from the world, for me, it just opened my eyes to such a different experience and such a different possibility. It was really a pivotal time in my life that I won't forget. I also must give comment to my grandmother and her two sisters, who were these inspiring, funky, ahead of their time women. That my grandmother in the 60s started a frozen food meal business, which was way ahead of its time, still in a society that believed, your wife must cook at home and, there was only home cooked meals. And she was determined that this could work. She had grown up in her work. She was a working woman too, cooking meals for professors at Wits University. They had a separate house where they could go for lunch, and but she took that further in terms of business opportunities, which was extraordinary for that age. And her other sister was was a golfing champion for South Africa, which also golf was not accessible to women. And the third sister was a nurse who got divorced, which was unheard of, and remarried. And she used to every night at 6 o'clock. She would have one cigarette, one cup of whiskey, and there was her favorite soap opera, and you could not speak to her at 6 p.m. because that was her nightly ritual. So imagine the fights over Christmas, but just growing up with these extraordinarily independent women that just advocated for different paths for themselves was definitely an influence in my life.
How inspiring. And as we close out today's conversation, please share a few words of motivation that you'd like to give to women and girls who are listening to us.
Don't give up. Keep trying. Just do it. I would say keep believing in yourself and keep learning and growing, and keep being your best. And I love the quote, you've heard me say it before, but keep stepping into the new version of your shiniest, noblest self because there's always more.
Thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate you sharing some of your personal anecdotes and also how we as organizations and society can make an impact to reinventing ourselves with confidence.
Thank you.
You have been listening to Womanity, Women in Unity, and we have been talking to Dr. Sarah Babb, who is an adjunct faculty member and professional associate of the University of Pretoria's Gordon Institute of Business Science and co-founder and managing director of STIM.
This is an MUT Radio podcast.